speaker is Brooke Nash, and Brooke is with the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, and is in the she is a health communication specialist for the Office of State, Tribal, Local, and Territorial Support. She'll talk to us about reaching children with high-risk medical conditions.
All right, good afternoon. Ooh, guys, that was bad. Good afternoon. Yes, you guys talk. Okay. So this time last year, what was the most popular search term on Google? I have nothing to give you. You got it. All right, so now stand up if you were working this time last year on H1N1. I'm a communication specialist. I need to know who my audience is. Thank you for your long work days. As anybody who has worked in public health response, it is something that you're days tend to blend together. So we're switching gears here, and that's what I'll be talking about for the next few minutes. So here's the timeline of events. I have never worked in emergency response. It was fascinating to me. If that world to you is also somewhat foreign, I encourage you to go to cdc.gov/CDCTV. There's going to be a list of all these videos, very consumer friendly. And there is a behind the scenes of the Emergency Operations Center. It's like a 6-minute video. Very interesting to see the world of emergency operations centers, which CDC is the federal level, and then there's a statewide EOC as well. So April 22nd is when the Emergency Operations Center was activated to respond to the H1N1. And in May, there was a children's health team that was formed. And the reason why is because there was a large number of calls coming into the CDC, specifically on children and H1N1. And what was really interesting was this was the first time, and I'm not even going along with my slides. So this was the first time in history that there was an actual team devoted to children's health during a public health response. And I was plucked, like you are during emergency responses, to work, somehow continue your 9-to-5, and then also work on H1N1. But it's something that is now near and dear to my heart, so I hope I can convince you guys to also be advocates after you leave here. At the same time these inquiries were coming in, our epidemiologists were tracking the data, and in September, the MMWR was released showing that there was a high prevalence of mortality amongst children that had underlying medical conditions. So primarily they were neurodevelopmental and pulmonary. So things like, I mean, your entire autism spectrum, right? ADHD, cerebral palsy, strokes, as well as all your pulmonary conditions like asthma. So what we did is we used this data to really drive our target audience. So at the same time that this information was coming out, we were meeting with our partners, we were doing some communication planning, and we found that this was our need right here. This was where we're going to get the most bang for our buck. So with the communication plan, this was the main objective that kind of fits targeting our high-risk, that vulnerable population of high-risk medical children with high-risk medical conditions. Primarily, as Michelle kind of led the way and introduced, parents were the key in this as well. The parents and the pediatric subspecialists. In an emergency response, we did not have any time to do formative research. I mean, the information, the brochures, everything was needed last week. So you really have to use what you have. So we did have some very generic audience profiling of moms with young children and moms with teens, and they really value their doctors for healthcare information. So that's what we had, and that's what we were going with. So am I not going? There we go. Okay. So our target audiences, besides the parents and the pediatricians, First of all, was internal CDC. There was a lot of movement going on during this response, and we had to make sure that everybody was using the same consistent messaging internally before we spoke externally. And also, we had a great team within the Emergency Operations Center that was talking with all of the states and local and territory health departments, so they were a big part of this as well. So again, part of the communication planning, these were our strategic efforts. We had to first define the list. So what did, I mean, there was constant debate about who should be included in this list of children with high-risk medical conditions. Then the internal communication that went along with that so we could externally communicate and then disseminate everything through our partners and media outreach. So defining the list, it was a collaborative effort stemming from the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices as well as the American Academy of Pediatrics and CDC. So the problem was, as you can see, and if you would copy and paste this into the Flesch-Kincaid reading scale, you have like a medical school grade level reading level here. So the challenge was, we're trying to target parents here. And if it's a parent that maybe just, they don't even know their child has asthma, is this gonna even relate to them? So, and we had multiple audiences, so we could keep this list one way for our healthcare providers, but then we had to completely change it for parents. So that was often a challenge. Once we got this list developed and cleared, which was another issue, we had to make sure that all of the task force and teams working on this response all had it. So that meant going back on to all of the web pages that even mentioned children, putting an asterisk and linking over to this list. It meant every piece of hard, you know, all the brochures and things that had been disseminated, we had to pull them, we had to update all of the versions, and it was a lot of just backtracking and internal communication to do that. So guidance was also something that primarily the healthcare field was really looking to us for, so the algorithms that they needed to vaccinate children, and that was something that was also constantly changing, and it still is changing, in fact. So just as a side note, and I'll come back to it, so the algorithm for this year for children that got the H1N1 vaccines last year, they only need one vaccine. Last year it was two, but since last year's had the H1N1, this year it's only one for the 9 years and under. Again, challenges were the complex messaging. I mean, the algorithms alone, I don't know if you've ever looked at those, but they're a nightmare for communicating externally. Version control, everything went through a joint information center, and when you have so many moving parts all going to one domain for clearance, sometimes it gets a little bottlenecked. And changing guidance as well. So while the list was being developed and materials were starting to being planned, we had a lot of partner requests. So we knew already the needs coming from our partners. And that's where, it's kind of like in the middle of these emergency responses, that's where you really are thankful for your partners. That's when it really matters, because you don't have that barrier of trying to build a partnership already. They already exist. So luckily we had that, and we had a lot of incoming requests of materials and needs to educate parents and pediatricians around this vulnerable population. Again, the challenge was that there was no formal audience research, which at CDC makes us a little nervous, but also plain language was really hard to do. We really try to be health literate conscious at CDC and make sure that we're really developing materials appropriate for our audiences. Again, without that message testing at the end, that last step, we didn't have that this time around. And CDC clearance. So I forgot to ask you guys, because I'm not following my notes, but on that long list, and I don't know if I can go back to it. I can. Does anything look awkward here on this list? So morbid obesity, Yeah, that's added this year. So in 2009, morbid obesity was not on there. Now 2010 guidance, morbid obesity, unfortunately, is on there. Those people with taking the aspirin therapy often are immunocompromised. So pregnancy was what I wanted someone to say. That was one of the issues, so talking about clearance issues. We got a lot of pushback, right? We're dealing with children here. Why are you putting pregnancy on a list? Okay, well, teenage pregnancy prevention, as many of us know, is a national problem. So, and then you're going into being pregnant, and if you get H1N1 or flu, just like any of these vulnerable populations, you have a higher chance of becoming sick or possibly even dying. So this was the brochure that we developed, very text heavy, but you know, we were proud to see that something finally was developed and mass disseminated electronically through all of our partners and state and local health departments. Specifically, that was specifically for parents, and this was the pediatric subspecialist toolkit. What we did find out with our, we had bi-monthly calls with all of our partners that for these children, they see their pediatric subspecialists more than they see their pediatricians. So we knew we had a target audience, a more specific target audience, and we knew that we had, it was the neurological pediatric neurologist had specifically asked for these types of toolkits. So this was something that we developed specifically for them, and it was housed on the website, and CDC uses Omniture to see how many hits that we're getting, and I don't have those results here, but they were tracked. Here was a list of our partners that, like I said before, we had been consistently working with them prior to the emergency response, which was really helpful. And then the healthcare providers, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and then CDC has clinician outreach and communication activities. It's a conference call, so if there's any clinicians out there, this is abbreviated COCA calls. This is something that's still going on, and actually there's going to be, next month there's going to be a call around this, children with high-risk medical conditions, so let me know if you're interested and I can get you an invite to that. So this is where I'm really excited about our outreach. It wasn't just the brochure and it wasn't just the toolkit. We pitched to Good Housekeeping and Vicki and Jen podcast. They reach hundreds of thousands of moms every year. And Medscape video, and that featured one of our team leads for the Children's Health team. So I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on the credible source. So with this Children's Health team, we had a team lead that was one of the most reputable developmental pediatricians, as well as a mother of four. Which one, being a developmental pediatrician or being a mother of four, which one do you think was more credible with the general public? Yeah, mother of four. The minute we said, like when we were pitching to some of these, like Vicki and Jen, the minute we said she was a mother of four, they said, well, is she going to get her children vaccinated? Absolutely she is. All right, great, we'll take her. Because she was able to make that personal connection. It was just one of those serendipitous moments that we had her a part of our team, because, you know, sometimes having all the letters at the end of the name, at the end of someone's name, doesn't always really matter. And again, there just was not enough time. We had so many different channels that we wanted to go through to get this information out there, and we just didn't have enough time. Luckily, it ended. So in conclusion, it was a very unique situation. Defining the list was kind of the first step, internal messaging, getting it all cleared. The good thing is that we got $500,000 to do formative research with parents and pediatric subspecialists, so that's what's going on actually right now. And so by 2011, we'll have all of those results implemented for that flu season. In the meantime, like I said, let me know if you're interested in that COCA call. We're going to have updated brochures for this flu season, also in Spanish. And you can go to cdc.gov/flu/free resources for a variety of free resources, as well as flu.gov. They've got a really great section for people, and they consider it people and include children with health conditions. And thank you to my team who made it all happen. Thank you all.
I'm inviting the panel to come up here. It's kind of a small platform. I have five chairs, and I'll take the questions and then direct them to the panel and step back. So, do we have some questions? Five people on this panel? Yes, Sue. Repeat your question. It's for Lori. Okay, for Lori and developing the campaign.
Sure. So we did conduct, with the formative research that was conducted, we had focus groups, online panels, and we also did creative testing with the materials that we did develop. And we started with our outcomes of interest, and obviously we wanted to reduce injuries and deaths, but that's a very long term. But in terms of promoting safe behaviors within the car, we brought all of our ideas to these after we developed the concepts of increasing safe passenger behavior, safe driver behaviors. We created our materials and then tested them with teens to make sure that it really resonated with them. And then they were able to subsequently use those materials and also customize them for their schools, however it would work best for them and their particular campaign.
Do you have another question? Yes.
Question for both of the safe driving proponents here. But actually, many years ago when I was in high school, you got those. And in order to go and take your, in my state, in order to go take your driving exam, first you were encouraged at least to have a whole semester worth, but driver's ed. And it was driver's ed and safety. And a lot of the message was, here are the things you don't want to do when you're driving, and here's, you know, here you are in an accident if you're wearing a seatbelt, here's your body if you're not wearing a seatbelt, any questions? And the gory scenes with accidents of drivers who weren't wearing one, that could also be something that was emphasized in health class, which was something that was offered in, you know, junior high and high school with emphasis primarily on first aid, preventing drug use, preventing sex, STD education, basically. But probably because they didn't, the question is, how was this integrated with the public school curriculum and the other opportunities that teachers and other authority figures in school had of trying to encourage safe driving once you got the license, or if they were piloting the car with somebody else? You know, I think the team with team was, hey, go with somebody else who's just got their license, and the more teams you have in the car without with the person, the more risk they take.
Okay, so the question for both of the presenters on teen driving is, how was this incorporated into other health education efforts that might have been being done at the schools or involving teachers, and kind of in the context of what some of us in this room remember as the old style of drivers, a warning for teen drivers, which was kind of the gory videos about this. So would you like to address that?
Well, in our particular campaign, we actually did not focus on scare tactics, and the central tagline, ride like a friend, drive like you care, we're actually promoting positive behaviors, and we didn't have any materials that showed the gory scenes, and we really wanted to make these positive behaviors normative among the teens, and that was a big focus for us, and we didn't want them to not do things. We wanted them to do things, to wear their seatbelt, to help the driver, to not distract the driver. So we really made a push in that direction instead of really talking about all the bad things that could happen and scaring them away from doing it.
So our campaign, it wasn't integrated in schools at all, and I think that I wish my colleague, Dr. Arlene Greenspan, who is the subject matter expert on teen driving, who was also one of the main developers of this campaign, so she could speak more specifically. But it's my understanding that actually a lot of schools these days don't have driver's education programs, and I think there's a lot of variability in those type of programs, and so we didn't want to focus on that specifically. What we base the campaign on, and I didn't talk about this a lot, is the components of graduated driver's licensing systems. And if folks, I don't know if y'all are familiar, but basically this is a new thing. 49 states and DC have graduated driver's licensing systems. And it's a staged approach to licensing so that new drivers start out with just limited privileges. They have to drive with someone else, they can't drive at night, they can't have passengers, and as they progress through it, they get these additional privileges. And research shows that the most comprehensive programs can have, 20 to 40% decrease in death, I believe is the number, but I could give more specific details to anyone who wants. So that policy change is, what can really make a big difference. But when GDL laws are passed, really parents are the ones who need to enforce them and actually, follow those rules in the home. And so that's why, since not all parents know about GDL, we just emphasize to them, nighttime driving is not a good idea, limiting passengers. And so I left your question a little bit, but basically we're not sure how effective the school programs are, so we're just trying to get to the things we do know are effective and get parents the information to support existing policies. Yeah, and the supervised practice driving is, an important thing that parents could do. So we just try and encourage those positive things that parents, we know that they can do.
Are there any other questions? Okay, if not, then thank you very much for being here, and thank you again to the panel.